Good morning.
Good morning.
What a gorgeous day. Welcome to the Monadnock Lyceum. I am Barbara Salvatore. I'm co-chair of Engaging New Hampshire, which is a citizen voice for the aging experience. And we are a member of the New Hampshire Alliance for Healthy Living, or Healthy Aging. We welcome you to the Monadnock Lyceum, and this chair rocks, a manifesto against ageism with Ashton Applewhite. Please join me in first thanking our wonderful musicians, August Waters, and he was on the mandocello, and Tony Brisden on the piano. And also thank you to the New Hampshire Alliance for Healthy Aging and the Endowment for Health for sponsoring this program. The Monadnock Lyceum hosts outstanding world-class speakers all from all over the world to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on issues that have national and global and local importance. The Monadnock Lyceum is recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio, and today's talk, if you want to hear it again, is going to be heard on next Sunday evening, the 27th, at 10 o'clock. In a few days, it will also be available on the website as a podcast, that is the MonadnockLyceum.org. Ashton was the 2016 PBS Next Avenues Influencer of the Year. She is a researcher, an author, blogger, humorist, and activist. Her first book was Truly Tasteless Jokes. She followed it by Cutting Loose, Why Women Who End Their Marriages Did So Well. But what brings her today to Peterborough is This Chair Rocks, because she has become a leading spokesperson for a movement to mobilize against age discrimination. She's recognized by the New York Times, National Public Radio, and the American Society on Aging as an expert on ageism. So, from the Library of Congress, from the United Nations, from TED Talks, she's now with us at the Monadnock Lyceum. Welcome, Ashton.
Thank you. Quite an honor to be standing where Emerson stood. Yikes. So the title of this talk is This Chair Rocks, How Ageism Warps Our View of Long Life. I began writing about aging because I was afraid of getting old. I didn't realize it at the time, but I realize a lot of things in hindsight. And I started out at what I came to call I'm Not Ray, Stage 1. Because for almost 18 years, I worked with this guy named Ray. And if Ray were heavier and wore red, he would be a dead ringer for Santa Claus. And he's proud of being a crank, and he's always complaining about his aches and pains, and he couldn't wait to retire to Florida. And when I found out that Ray and I were exactly the same age, I panicked. I thought, what if everyone finds out they'll think I'm old too? That wasn't just condescending and mean-spirited of me. It was idiotic. But old to me meant sad and sick, right? I didn't want to think about it. When it crossed my mind, I flipped the channel. But in 2017, my ears perked up at a comment from my mother-in-law, Ruth Stein. She and her husband, Bill, were in their 80s at the time, and they're booksellers. And she said over dinner one night, "Why don't you write about something people ask us all the time? So when are you going to retire?" So I liked the idea, and I started a blog called SoWhenAreYouGoingToRetire.com. And I started learning about longevity and interviewing people over 80 who work. And finding people turned out to be the easiest thing about this whole project. People were always saying, "Oh, you should talk to the piano teacher down the hall, or my accountant, or the guy who sells ices in the park." I met Jemsy DeLapp, choreographer and muse of Agnes DeMille, who said of her life, "I danced straight on through." And she blamed her heart medication for the fact that when I try to demonstrate standing on one leg, I begin to slowly drift So I just grab hold of the nearest strong dancer, girl or boy. I met Eddie Mae Holmes, who was a shipyard welder during World War II. She's teeny, and she could squeeze between the double hulls. And then she became a nurse, and then she became the proprietor of the Holmes Family Barbershop in Richmond, California. And she told me, don't let anybody push you. If a good-looking fella comes along, wants to take you to dinner, that's okay, but if he doesn't have anything in his pocket, don't go. I met a lounge pianist, Irving Fields, who got hooked on Latin music on a cruise ship to San Juan in his 20s, and whose big hit was called Bagels and Bongos. And he told me, I play better now than I did 20 years ago. I take more chances. He said, I used to lie to booking agents about my age, but now that I'm in my 90s, I flaunt it. So this really strange thing was happening. The more I read and the more people I talked to, the bigger the gap in my mind between what I was seeing with my own eyes and learning and the reality. So what were some of my assumptions? Well, the grimmest was that the odds were pretty good that I would end my days drooling under a bad botanical print in some grim institutional hallway. So, in fact, the percentage of Americans over 65 in nursing homes, it's 4%, and it's dropping. I saw 3% in Time magazine not long ago, right? The vast majority of Americans can go about, older Americans, even the old, go about their everyday lives without any personal assistance. So what about being sick and being helpless? Over half of the oldest old do just fine. People get chronic illnesses, right? It's not that stuff doesn't go wrong with our bodies and sometimes with our minds, but we keep on persisting in the things that are the most important and meaningful to us, right? We learn to live with them. I learned that from another woman I interviewed, Ava Zeisel, who was an industrial designer, and I interviewed her. She was almost 100, and she was blind from macular degeneration. So she learned to design using balsa wood models. I watched her working on a big silverware commission for Bloomingdale's, and I asked her if it was harder to work like that, and she shook her head firmly, and she said the process, getting shapes out of the air, was always the same, right? So like Zeisel, many of the oldest old live well not by avoiding illness, but despite it. Another preconception, dementia lurks. My memory has never been any good, so maybe I won't notice if I join the 1 out of 9 Americans who has Alzheimer's. It is a terrifying prospect, but if you subtract that 4% of Americans over 65 in nursing homes, 90% of the remainder can think just fine. Right? The numbers of people with Alzheimer's are growing because they're more older people as a percentage of the population. But even as the population ages, the number of the rates of Alzheimer's are dropping precipitously. Right? That's what you never hear. I'm not a Pollyanna about aging, but I want to hear both sides of the story out there. The likelihood of any given person getting dementia has fallen significantly lower and lower, and it's getting diagnosed at later ages. Right? So the real epidemic is anxiety over memory loss. And there's stuff we can do to help us stay cognitively fit. So what about another assumption I had? Old people don't have sex. Sexual activity does tend to diminish with age, but my 74-year-old friend Robin is having the best sex of her life, and she is not an anomaly. Retirement homes are hotbeds of romance. Less cheerfully, almost 1 out of 6 new diagnoses of HIV is in the population over 50, with sex being the mode of transmission, primary mode in that population. So thank you, Viagra. Another assumption, old people are depressed because they're old and they're going to die soon. It turns out that the longer people live, the less they fear dying, and that people are happiest at the beginnings and the ends of their lives, right? It's called, they enjoy better mental health. It's called the U-curve of happiness. Google it. And it has been borne out by dozens of studies, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And it's not a function of being wealthy or of being healthy, both of which I was sure when I first heard that statistic it couldn't be the case. It's a function of the way aging itself affects the brain. So things started looking so much better that I graduated to I'm Not Ray, Stage 2. Trumpet the fact that Ray and I are the same age because look how much younger I look. Weirdly, counterintuitively, exhilaratingly, the more I learned about aging, the less terror it held. And this is true across the board. AARP and USC did a study that established that, quote, less knowledge about aging is associated with greater anxiety about the aging process. So most of the respondents were aware that older Americans can learn, are either working or want to work, and feel healthy. But most of them also thought of most older people as senile, pretty much alike, and having no capacity for sex, unquote. So no wonder they're nervous. In this society, we see age, old age, only through the lens of loss. And what people lose is more obvious than what we gain. And those losses are real and wrenching. But from the inside, the experience is different. Life remains very much worth living. A geriatrician at Johns Hopkins put it in a way that really stuck with me. His mantra was a Mexican saying that the appearance of the bull changes when you enter the ring, right? Looks different to the matador. The sight of an old woman hunched over a walker used to make me mutter, put me out of my misery, if I ever get like that. And now I mutter, just as fervently, the bull looks different. The bull looks different. A friend's father was completely paralyzed along his entire left side by a stroke when he was 76, and he spent the next 17 years of his life in a wheelchair in a nursing home. And after one routine visit, he told her, I have to say, this has been about a perfect day. And her last present to him at his request was a Berlitz textbook because he wanted to learn to speak Spanish with one of his assistants. I had to acknowledge and confront my own prejudices, my assumption, for example, that my friend's father would have been better off dead. As the saying goes, there are very few people who want to live to be 100, and most of them are in their late 90s. Another handy saying among geriatricians, and I have heard them say this, if you've seen one 80-year-old, you've seen one 80-year-old. Right? I mean, if you think about it, compare a group of 14-year-olds to a group of 74-year-olds, or even a high school reunion. As we age, we grow more different from one another, right? So, which means that the older you are, the less that number says about what you're capable of or interested in or anything important about you. So why, then, are we so afraid of aging? Why do we assume that everyone in a retirement home is the same age? That would be old. When they can span four decades, because of aging, hopefully defined already for us, discrimination and stereotyping on the basis of age. It is ageist to assume that all olders are frail or wise, or that kids are like that. Ageism cuts both ways, right? It's any judgment about a person or a group of people on the basis of how old we think they are. It is ageist when some clown calls me young lady and expects me to feel flattered. It is ageist and ableist when olders refuse to use wheelchairs or walkers because the stigma is so great, even when it means never leaving home. Ageism is to age what racism is to race. Both are socially constructed ideas. That means we make them up, all right? They're not based in biology. And they have changed over time, and they serve a social and economic purpose. They are not about how we look. They are about what people in power want our appearance to mean. Ageism is pervasive and corrosive, and yet many people can't even define it. And they have no sense of how we internalize it, right? How these negative values become part of our fundamental sense of ourselves, and how it plays out in society and demeans and distorts our life course. Quote, it's as if nobody has a good old age anymore, let alone a good death, writes age scholar Margaret Gallette. Something in American culture blocks out the joyful and political images, causing people to leap over them to final images of decrepitude, pain, abuse, and demeaning death, unquote. Aging is medicalized like a disease and commercialized as an opportunity to sell all kinds of stuff to the silver market. Actually, not all kinds of stuff, mostly cruises and medicine, let's face it. But what a market, right? Because everyone is going to come down with it. So, slowly, skeptically, my point of view began to change. I realized that getting older was almost certainly going to be really different and probably a lot better than the grim slide into depression, dementia, and puffy white shoes of my nightmares. Although I'm still worried about the shoes. Seriously, that was before I had to start seeing a podiatrist. So I changed the name of my blog to Staying Vertical, which is my exhortation to get up out of bed if a late night excursion is involved. But staying vertical is only a metaphor, and it turned out to be another misconception on my part, because you don't need to stay vertical and be mobile to age well. And my in-laws set the example there. Bill Stein shattered his ankle when the B-17 he was piloting over Belgium was shot down. And Ruth had polio and post-polio syndrome, and she couldn't walk more than 3 feet unaccompanied. But she was the most vertical person I know. Her mode was denial. Powered by luck and willpower, it propelled them into their 10th decade. They died this February, just 8 days apart, at 93 and 95, peacefully in their beds at home. And that brings me to I'm Not Ray, stage 3. I'm not Ray, and I'm not Ruth. Ray is going to be happy as a clam in Florida. He just retired this spring, and it is the old age he wants. Denial worked for Ruth right to the end, which was a lesson for me. And I'm working towards an old age that I want, and it's not going to look like either of theirs. If I can't stay vertical, well, this chair rocks, the name I finally settled on for the project. I am not saying that getting older is easy, right? We're all worried about some aspect of it, whether running out of money, ending up alone, getting sick. And those fears are legitimate and real. But what never dawns on most of us is that the experience of reaching old age, or middle age, or even just aging past youth, this stuff starts early, these messages, right? That to age is to fail, can be better or worse depending on the culture in which it takes place, right? America's relentlessly youth-centric cultural drumbeat drowns out all but the negative about life after 65, or 50, when men dump their wives for fertile trophy versions, or 40, when workplace discrimination kicks in legally, and often actually even younger, or 30, when women start to freak out about being over the hill at 30. My daughter-in-law's best friend was a model. She's in her early 30s. She doesn't have a partner at the moment, and she is panicked at the prospect of the next 60 years of her life because of this message in the culture. That's messed up. Unless we challenge the underlying message that to age is to lose value as a human being, which is what I love about the sign out front of this Lyceum, that to age is to lose value as a human being, it becomes part of our identity. That's internalized ageism. The more clearly we see these social forces at work, on the other hand, the easier it is to come up with alternative, more positive, and more accurate narratives. Dementia is often the elephant in the room. Physical mobility is relative, but if you lose your marbles, you're screwed. Alzheimer's is an evil disease. The odds increase with age. We're nowhere near a cure. But we do know that some people whose brains were full of Alzheimer's-type plaques and tangles stayed sharp as tacks to the end. And we think it's because they built what neuroscientists call cognitive reserve, which just means more neurons and the connections between them. And they used to think that only young people, we built them and then it was just a process of loss. We now know that we can continue to build our brains right through life. And we built it by exercising and maintaining social networks and challenging our brains. And we also know, and this is so interesting, there's more research about it all the time, that attitudes towards aging have an actual measurable effect on how our brains and bodies function. People with more positive feelings towards aging walk faster, they do better on memory tests, they're more likely to recover fully from severe disability, and they live longer, an average of 7.5 years longer. And it seems obvious to me that they live better, right? Because they have less of that sort of reflexive dread. There are no guarantees. My godmother, Anne, had an insatiably curious mind, and at 95, memory loss has her on a very short loop, and it's growing shorter all the time. And it is wretched for the people caring for her. But she knows me, and the characteristics I love best, her humor, her imagination, her courage, are still there, along with the imperiousness and self-indulgence that have always made her a pain in the butt. I am still available to her, and she to me. Here's the thing. Most forgetfulness is not Alzheimer's, or dementia, or even necessarily a sign of cognitive impairment. And here, right? I mean, they say if you can't remember what keys are for, you probably do have a serious problem. But if you can't remember where you put them, that most of us, 20% of the population escapes cognitive decline entirely. Right? We all know some of those really sharp older people. Most of us are going to lose some of that processing where you can't remember the name of that movie you saw with what's her name. But that doesn't mean that the floodgates are open to dementia. It doesn't keep us from functioning fine in the world to the end. That's the point. Here's where ageism comes in. Any prophecy about debility, whether or not it comes true, damages our sense of self, right, and limits our aspirations. I used to make senior moment jokes. I thought they were cute until finally it dawned on me that when I lost the car keys in high school, I didn't call it a junior moment, right? Kids forget things too all the time. As for mobility, it's all relative. Bill and Ruth could barely walk, but they arranged their life and their kitchen and their lives so they didn't have to. I hurt all the time. What my grandmother called stiffness, my orthopedist calls stenosis, my acupuncturist calls chi stagnation, and my GP says is arthritis. And I talk about it to my physical therapist, and I try not to talk about it much to anyone else because it's boring, and I don't want to give it more bandwidth. I have to remind myself that pain is just pain, and that not all of it is age-related. The objective is to keep doing the things I want to do, and so far so good, although the goalposts are shifting. I'm always reminding people who are like, this old thing is going to happen and it's all going to be awful. It's like, you are already on that path, right? You already can't do many things the same way you used to, and yet you are still moving really happily through your life, right? There's no like cliff that we fall off. I used to whiz along on my bicycle, and now I am very much in the slow lane. I still barrel along the sidewalk. I live in New York, but I had to slow down recently for a friend in her 70s who was visiting, whose knees were killing her, arthritis. She marveled that it had happened to her, and I will marvel when it happens to me. And I'll buy a cane, just like she did, and keep going, just a little more slowly. I moved to a Brooklyn neighborhood 12 years ago with a median age of about 23, and I said to myself that when I could no longer hustle up and down the subway steps as fast as the kids, well, that would be when it was time to move. That was during I'm Not Ray stage 2, look how great I'm doing. And now I let the hipsters pass, or I ask them to help me with my bags. I make myself do it, and I don't have to force myself anymore because I said to myself, what am I waiting for? And, you know, whoever I ask to help is like puffs up his chest like Galahad, you know? He's really happy to help. I mean, that's another topic. But, you know, when you ask someone to help, it almost always makes them feel good. So what about sex? When I was in my 20s, I knew that I was having the best sex ever and that no one over 30 was having any sex at all. Silly me. Those are not the memories I cling to. That said, stuff does fall apart. It was a bad day when I was diagnosed with periodontal disease and vaginal thinning in the same morning. So floss and the yellow Listerine that tastes like kerosene do the trick above the right waist. And my gynecologist prescribed an S-ring. It releases a low dose of estrogen, and it does the trick, too. Although my friend with the bad knees told me you can't use it if you've had cancer. She's a breast cancer survivor. And she has had a fantastic sex life, but now less more for tenderness. She said to me, you can be intimate with someone in so many different ways. Sex doesn't have to involve erections. Some men are glad not to be led around by their libidos anymore. It can be great to let the whole thing go, if that's your choice. But it's easy for older women to feel the choice isn't up to us, especially straight women confronting a dearth of available men over 55, most of whose sights are firmly set on the premenopausal anyhow. A few years ago, an adorable young guy came up to me at a dance club, and he told me I looked like Susan Sarandon. And then instantly, his face clouded over, and he blurted, I meant it as a compliment. He wasn't saying that I look like Susan Sarandon. He was saying, you look old and you look hot. A statement so apparently contradictory in this culture that being compared to bodacious Susan Sarandon came across as an insult. I wish it were funny. It is funny. American girls are sexualized at 8 and ushered over the hill 2 decades later. You don't hear look less slutty or look less Asian, but look less old messages are everywhere, especially for women, who become invisible sooner and often cruelly. This is bigotry. When we accept the message that older equals ugly and freeze our faces with a needle or a scalpel or dye our hair to cover the gray or lie about our age, we reinforce it. These are really successful strategies, and I completely understand why so many people do these things. No judgment, I swear. But behaviors like this are like a gay person trying to pass for straight or a person of color trying to pass for white. They're not good for us, right? Because they're based in shame about something that should not be shameful. And from a political point of view, it gives a pass to the discrimination that makes these behaviors necessary. Aging means living. So think twice about what anti-aging products promise. Allure magazine just this week banned the term anti-aging from its magazine, which is pretty cool. Things are happening. So compare today's fashions to what people wore in colonial America, where old age was not shunned but exalted, probably in this very room. So probably partly because not that many people actually achieved old age, and older men held the reins, and think about what they wore. White wigs and stiff frock coats and stockings that exposed the lower legs, fashions that flatter the older body. The point is that fashion represents values that are socially constructed, right? We make them up. They're malleable. We can change them. You and I can choose where we find beauty, and we needn't stop at 22. When MAC Cosmetics launched a line of lipsticks inspired by New York style icon Iris Apfel, I bet you guys would recognize the picture of her. She has short white hair and those big dark brown specks, and she wears very dark red and scarlet lipsticks, and they sold out instantly. And I wrote a blog post about it, and a friend of mine commented that it reminded her of a book she owns called How Not to Look Old. Quote, it's full of tips like wear soft pink shimmery lipstick so it doesn't draw attention to your wrinkled mouth. And it's true, it really works, Kelly wrote. And that got me wondering, at what point will I stop caring about not looking my age and just wear what I like, unquote. Maybe never. Maybe that would signal defeat. Maybe victory, right? This stuff is complicated. The book is right about the lipstick, damn it. Sometimes I reach for a gentler color, and sometimes I reach for the red. Getting older has made me a lot more forgiving of my physical shortcomings, and that is welcome. My butt and thighs were the source of endless misery in my 20s and teens. But now that I'm in my 60s, I look down and think, you know, not bad. I never thought I would be going strong so long after my sell-by date, and I'm hoping for a lot more company. I feel the same way about the rest of my social life, for which a lot of credit goes to my partner, who is an amazing culture scout. But unless we are at a simulcast of the Metropolitan Opera, we are almost always the oldest people in the room, and often by decades, because we like weird music and, you know, off Broadway, blah, blah. And we don't like it, but we don't want to stay home just because we'll stick out. And I think of it as affirmative action, which is really important. It's not, you know, not that we should do things that we don't want to do because they'll make us look young, because honestly, you can only look however old you are. That's how old it looks, right? There's no such thing as actually looking young. But that if there is something you do want to do and you are concerned that you will be the oldest people there, I urge you not to have that be a reason to stay home for yourself and also for the message that you put out in the world by showing up. One year, we went to a big electronic outdoor music festival with a median age of about 12, I swear, and people were actually taking pictures of Bob and me, which was kind of creepy, but also well-intentioned, and we made two good friends who were in their late 20s at the time, and it's 10 years later now, and we're very close friends with them still. And that's what a woman, the very first time I gave this talk, she said, "We're real friends," to me. She came up afterwards. And she was talking about a friend of her daughter's who was a fan of the same rock band, an English rock band named Muse. And this woman had missed out on a wild youth and discovered rock music in her 50s and become an avid concert goer, usually alone. And she was having a blast. And she's brave. And what she's doing wouldn't call for courage in a less ageist society, right? So, not to turn this happy groupie into Rosa Parks, but that is how desegregation happens. People with the most at stake, which means olders in this case, step up and step out. We stop conforming. And the open-minded welcome us, and that's how incremental social change takes place. Sometimes being with younger friends makes me feel younger, and sometimes it makes me feel ancient. And it's complicated for them, too. I know what they're thinking because I used to think it. They're thinking, I hope I age as well as Ashton, and I hope that never happens to me. It's true. And while I hope I'll be able to wipe my own butt to the end, I'm going to need help shoveling. Shoveling. You guys know all about shoveling. And schlepping. And I want to be able to cast a wide net. My worst nightmare is not being able to read, so I was soothed by the story of a woman who lost her vision to macular degeneration in her 70s. And she grieved. And then she had a book giveaway party. And three different friends offered to come once a week and read to her. And she keeps three books going at a time. And she loves those sessions. But just as importantly, so do her readers, right? The terms and power dynamics are going to shift. The goal is to give and receive with grace. And we have time to practice. The key, it seems to me, is to embrace the idea that dependence is no more shameful at the end of life than at the beginning, or maybe even to swap out, get rid of that whole idea, that whole term dependence, and swap it out for interdependence. Because all of life is interdependent, from birth to death. This whole American myth of go it alone is flawed, I think, and deeply destructive, and certainly not our friend as we get older. We're all going to need help at the very end, although not nearly as much as all the horror stories about living too long would have us believe. What live too long really means is cost too much. Although only about 3% of the 4,800 Americans over 65 who die every day incur high costs, and those costs would be lower if the American medical system weren't geared towards keeping a lot of us alive at any cost, because those high-tech interventions are profitable and lousy at helping us die well, although I think the hospice movement and palliative care are emerging to help us address those problems in a wonderful way. The greatest worry for most people is becoming a burden to our community, our doctors, our families. It has become commonplace to hear even healthy, middle-aged people wondering whether the alternative to becoming a burden will be to commit suicide. And just think about that for a minute. Not because they ran out of money, not because they're sick, not because they don't have friends and family to call on, just because they get old. That is internalized ageism of the most lethal sort. And it is the logical outcome of a political system that is hostile to paying for the health and well-being of its most vulnerable citizens. And I actually include children in that too, right? Because that's ageism too. The people at either end of the age spectrum are the most powerless politically. Well, old people are actually a really powerful voting bloc, but that's a tangent. We can go into that. I have made out a living will and a healthcare proxy and talked them over with my family and my doctor. And of course, that conversation is critically important, because if we're too squeamish to talk about what we want, how can we expect more of the medical establishment? And it needs to be an ongoing conversation. My partner's healthcare proxy is his son, because he thinks I'll pull the plug the minute he stops being entertaining. I like to keep him worried. Mine is my sister, because it'll be easier for her to pull the plug when the time comes, and I think that's what I'll want, but the bull looks different, right? I am a lot less certain about a lot of this than I used to be. Older bodies benefit just as much from aggressive medical treatment, including serious interventions like CPR and dialysis and organ transplants, as younger bodies, right? The indicator should not be your age, but your overall health and organ function. Older people have the right to want to stay alive, right? The criteria for medical procedures, according to bioethicist Felicia Ackerman, should be, quote, the desire to stay alive, medical need, and a reasonable chance that the procedure will work, unquote. That's it. I want those choices, and I bet you all do too. I used to be flipped out by the dying part of getting older, but that's looking better too. It turns out that the old don't worry about dying. They don't want to die, and they really don't want to die in pain, but it doesn't fill their thoughts, right? And it was true of the people I interviewed. I encountered it from geriatricians, and eventually I read the research about it. And I know why. Because the awareness that time is short doesn't fill people with dread. It makes us spend our time more wisely, and it makes us be more selective about who we spend that time with. So Living in the moment is what makes people happy, and that's one of the reasons I've become an old person in training, a phrase I appropriated from another geriatrician, because I know I'm not young, I don't see myself as old, and I know a lot of people feel the same way. We're in the grips of this paradox, right? Nobody wants to die young, and yet a lot of us are very afraid of the opposite. So we spend a lot of energy sustaining the illusion that old people are somehow other than us, right? That othering that feeds all social prejudice. So becoming an old person in training bridges that us-them divide. It's not, thinking way ahead doesn't come naturally to us humans, but we're engineered to live in the present. So you can make that old person version of you as far ahead down the horizon as you need it to be, but once you acknowledge that you will get old, you don't get stuck on this hamster wheel of denial. I don't know what it's going to be like to be 90, but I'm a lot less apprehensive about it than I used to be. Becoming an old person in training is also a tactical challenge, right? Exercise, make new friends, hold on to friends of all ages, right? And that's really important, getting off our butts. You all probably cross-country ski, you know, 50 miles every day in the winter, so more power to you. I try and get on my bicycle. A dash of demography. Thanks largely to clean water and antibiotics, the American lifespan has increased by 30 years in the 20th century. A lot of we outsource death from the young to the old, so more people survive to adulthood, but we've gained about 10 healthy years in whatever stage of life I'm in. The outlook for Black Americans is less rosy. Lifespans of the least educated Americans are actually contracting. Growing economic inequality, the premature deaths of the less fortunate, is slowing this fundamental measure of human progress. But for those of us with access to health care and education, for the first time in human history, four living generations are becoming commonplace. We're going to have more time to figure out what we want to do with our lives, and more time to accomplish it, and more time to wind down with the people we love. So to exploit this extraordinary achievement, we need to overturn the grotesque notion that two-thirds of life is decline, right? That idea that has my daughter-in-law's friend paralyzed with fear. There is no line in the sand, no crossover between old and young after which it's all downhill. And this imaginary threshold segregates us and fills us with dread. So we need to reject the zero-sum reasoning that pits the old against the young. There is no evidence that young people want to throw granny to the wolves, and more resources have always flowed from older people to younger ones. This us or them logic always pops up around healthcare rationing. Why should we spend money on old people who are going to die soon when we could spend it on kids? They don't say the die soon part out loud. Next time you hear that, think about this. We know it's not okay to allocate resources by race or by sex. Why should it be okay to weigh the needs against the young, of the young against the old? It's not okay, the whole line of logic, of argument. We need to question alarmist demography that depicts longevity as something we can't afford. We can if we want to. We have plenty of money for the Pentagon. It's a question, of course, of the fact that resources are not inherently scarce, but of how we want to spend them. This scarcity, again, is the result of policy decisions. So when you hear that two-thirds of life is decline, or that it's old versus young, or that we can't afford longevity, don't buy it. Two characteristics of marginalized populations: self-loathing and passivity, what my daughter tactfully dubbed the, quote, yuck-slash-pity factor that the prospect of growing old invokes in so many. Shame can damage self-esteem and quality of life as much as externally imposed stigma. Becoming an old person in training is also a political act because it derails this shame and self-loathing, and it undoes the otherness that powers ageism and racism and nationalism and all prejudice. It makes room for empathy and action. In the 20th century, the civil rights and women's movements woke us up to entrenched systems of racism and sexism around us. In recent decades, the gay rights movement has made incredible strides against homophobia, and yet ageism has barely bleeped onto our radar, right? Who even blinks when older people are described as incompetent or confused or even repulsive? It is high time to mobilize against discrimination on the basis of age, and it is happening all around us. When do we stop valuing people and why? Not because we grow old, but because we do so in an ageist society. What kind of world do we want to grow old in? And for our children and grandchildren, who may well live to be 100, to inherit? It is time for a radical aging movement. If you want to do something, the next time you're at a social event, go talk to the oldest or youngest person in the room. It is really critical to form friendships of all ages. The next time you whisper, put a pillow over my head if I get like that, remember, the bull looks different. And the next time you wonder whether an outing or an outfit or an attitude is age appropriate, reevaluate the question. For adults, there is no such thing. It is time for a radical aging movement. I'm in it. I hope you will join me. Thank you.